There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
FM Talk 106.5. It's Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan on a rainy Thursday afternoon. Well, was rainy. Now it's kind of clearing up a little bit. But let us know what you think. 251-343-0106. We have a tweet in telling us there's a four-vehicle wreck on I-65 heading northbound just north of Dauphin Street. So if you're out on the roads, especially with it being so slick, just keep an eye out for that today. Joining me as always was Dalton Orwig.
How you doing,
kinda
Jeff?
Kind of holding my hand as I
not true at all.
As I endeavor a radio career somehow, some way. Got a few texts on the text line. You says,
yeah, 343-0106. We've been getting some texts in over the last hour. First off, some images from not only the storm from this morning. We got pictures from Lake Forest Subdivision in Daphne, where it looks like a tree down there. I know Vista Ridge had some damage in Tillman's Corner here in Mobile, but also someone sent in some damage left over in Panama City from Hurricane Michael. I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier, some of the damage that you see there in the panhandle left over from the hurricane. But then a couple texts also on your interview last hour with House Speaker Mac McCutcheon. Someone says the speaker was a great guest. I would like to hear more from him. Good interview. And also an unnamed texter said, talking about the gas tax, well, talking about several things that you talked with Mac McCutcheon about. He said, I'm going to vote no if the gas tax does come up, and I will still vote no for the new bridge across Mobile Bay if I had a choice on that, and also no lottery and no gambling in Alabama.
Dr. No there,
Dr.
right?
Dr. No. All, knows all the way around.
What is the state government? What's the purpose of the state government, I wonder, in this texter's mind?
Not much.
Yeah. Well, I guess the law enforcement or whatever it is, but, the state government plays a role, guys, and I think there's a lot around the state that's left to be desired and that could be improved upon. So, you know, whether that's worth a tax hike or something, I think that's debatable. But I do think that there's a status quo that needs to be improved upon. What else do we got? Anything else?
That does it for the good texts. Now we do have more texts, but that does it for the really good ones. And you can text us your thoughts, 251-343-0106, or give us a call. We have open phone lines until you have a guest coming up.
Coming up bottom of the hour, got Joe Pollack with Breitbart News, my colleague at Breitbart. He's an editor there. He hosts a radio show on Sirius XM. He knows a lot about sort of constitutional law. I mean, he attended classes taught by Alan Dershowitz, and he has like a unique perspective that I think a lot of people have, but he's got the educational background to kind of talk a little bit about it in detail and what the 14th Amendment really says about birthright citizenship. I know it's a big debate right now. Trump brought it up in this Axios interview that's supposed to air on HBO. I think there's a lot of clips coming from it, but that was the big one. He talked about ending birthright citizenship, which is the idea that you could come to the United States as if you're born on U.S. soil, that means you're automatically a U.S. citizen. That interpretation of the 14th Amendment, I think, is up a questionable call in the minds of a lot of people, especially the way the Constitution's written. He's going to talk a little bit about that and where that sort of came, what that was born out of. It was a court decision. I think it was a footnote, I believe, by Justice Brennan. Making the declaration that if you're born on the soil, if you're here, if your parents are here legally or whatever, if you're here and you have a layover at Atlanta Hartsfield International Airport and you are given birth to at Terminal F or whatever, then you're a U.S. citizen. So, like, was that really the intention of that amendment? And I think there's some question about it. And if we're going to read it just as a, you know, a strict constructionist point of view, then maybe, you know, maybe the birthright thing is something that needs to be revisited on a constitutional level and not statutory and not, obviously not through an executive order.
And birthright citizenship, of course, has become a huge issue over the last few weeks leading into the midterms, and President Trump speaking a lot about it at each of his Make America Great Again rallies. And yesterday the president began a trip through 8 states leading into the midterms, and Florida will be one of those states. He'll be in Pensacola come Saturday.
Yeah, and he was just in Fort Myers last night. Oh. The race, there's two big races there. Obviously, the gubernatorial race. My mayor, Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee, and Congressman, and now former Congressman, Ron DeSantis, are facing off, and that was the matchup we've all been waiting for. It was the ideologue, socialist Bernie Sanders kind of candidate versus the Trump Make America Great Again guy who, you know, really is for the wall, for immigration and limits and trade policy and all these things. And we were going to get that. Meanwhile, kind of on the side there is the U.S. Senate race, and that's kind of the middle. That's the fight for the heart of Florida. That's the I-4 corridor battle. That's Rick Scott, the current governor of Florida, and the incumbent Senator Bill Nelson, who's been a senator in Florida forever. It makes it really tough because you have two kind of incumbent politicians that are able to raise a lot of money, and they're just bloodying each other up. Meanwhile, I think the one everyone's interested in is that gubernatorial race. So you have the ideological fight on one end, and you have this bloodbath sort of going on in the middle, trying to win over swing voters. So it's a statewide affair all the way from Key West to Pensacola, and I think that's Trump is obviously he's got two. There's two pathways there for Republicans. You got to run up the score in the panhandle because that's where all the Republican voters for the most part are in Florida, and then you got to win over the hearts and minds in the middle of Florida. You know, generally the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach, that's Democrat leaning. Those tend to be the blue counties, but that's where a lot of population is. Same with Orlando. Tampa and St. Petersburg flip-flop, but you got to win over that I-4 corridor that stretches from Daytona Beach all the way to St. Petersburg, and that's kind of where presidential elections have been decided. So there's two fronts. There's a base election, and then there's the swing vote election, and that's kind of where Trump's, you know, that I think that's his focus in this midterm.
With the governor's race here in Alabama, I don't think it's been as heated as some people probably thought. I think the poll numbers are right around where people thought it would be to begin with, but Maddox has not gone as dirty politics, I think, as he could have. He could have really dragged this race into the gutter, but how dirty is that governor's race, gubernatorial race over there in Florida between DeSantis and Gillum?
That's really dirty. So the Gillum question. So Gillum was always like kind of thought of as an afterthought. He was kind of going to be the third or fourth place finisher in the Democratic primary. I think the favorite was Gwen Graham, a former congresswoman, daughter of a former governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham. Gillum had a late surge, surprised, I think, all the political watchers, and won that primary. But the problem with Gillum has always been he's had this kind of cloud of FBI investigation hanging over him. There's pictures of him with an undercover FBI agent that was posing as a lobbyist. What on earth is an undercover FBI agent posing as a lobbyist doing with Andrew Gillum? They took a trip together to New York City, one to Costa Rica. There's all these kind of weird questions, and I don't think Gillum's ever sufficiently put that fire out. I think it just looks bad, and he's never really addressed it properly. That's why this race is, you know, I think coming out of the gate, if you recall, DeSantis had like kind of a faux pas. He said monkeying around, mm-hmm. and he got turned around on him, and it was racist or whatever. But he never really recovered from that. So the real interesting thing is they're going at each other. I think Gillum's trying to respond to some of DeSantis's attacks with the idea that DeSantis is born out of this culture, the alt-right or whatever. I think it's a bit of a stretch, but to a base, when you want to churn out your base, that's the kind of red meat you got to throw out there, and that's the kind of thing you got to do to get Democrats to come out and vote. So that's kind of where that is. It's as intriguing as you would expect it to be because of the just how the gulf between the two ideological sides. This is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan here on FM Talk 106.5. Give us a call, let you know what you think. 251-343-0106.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And this is not Sean Sullivan. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan, who's away today. We were coming back from the break. We were talking a little bit about Florida, but let's switch gears here and real quick talk about my Lagniappe piece that just got up today. It is on stands all around Mobile, so be sure to get it if you can. But newspaper editorial endorsements. The editorial boards, the various newspapers around the state, the old legacy media, used to really mean something to get a newspaper endorsement, especially in a one-party state. But now you have a newspaper structure that doesn't really reflect what the readers, where they are on certain issues or where they are on issues altogether, I think. So you look at these newspapers and they're all, well, the AL.com stuff hasn't really come out yet. I suspect they'll do something big and grand, but I think I know where they're going to go politically. But so far, the Anniston Star, long-time left-wing paper, George Wallace dubbed it the Red Star because it seemed to be pro-Soviet, according to Wallace. Decatur Daily, Times Daily, up in the Tennessee Valley, they're going hard Democrat, and they're talking about voting out these sort of institutions like Mo Brooks, who's been around in Alabama politics for a long time, kind of a more of your ideologically rigid members of Congress, and definitely in the state of Alabama. They want him out. They're backing the Democrat candidates. And it's a star, I think, from top to bottom, except for one race, statewide went Democrat. And the one race was John Merrill, Secretary of State. And how would you like to be the only Democrat? The Anniston Star did not endorse.
Unbelievable.
Now, I don't think these newspaper endorsements mean much, but they're instructive in that they tell you kind of like where these newspapers look at the world and the way they look at things. If they're like so slanted, they can't go 50-50 Republican-Democrat split. They go all Democrats, and they have an ideological reason, be it, voter ID. They're against voter ID, or they think that Medicaid should be expanded. They think taxes should be higher, that everybody needs to pay their fair share. They think that there's places in Alabama that aren't getting a fair shake, the more wealthy counties need to move their education dollars out of those precincts and move them into other parts of the state. They have all these ideas that don't really mesh up with the rest of the state. I think that says a lot about the way they cover things and the kind of the side of the story you're getting when you pick up a copy of the Press Register. If anybody does that anymore, I guess most people just go to AL.com. But when you pick up these newspapers and you look at it, you're seeing this view of the world, and everything's kind of being captured from a left-of-center perspective. And that just, and it's not even that they're open to the ideas that this is the way things should be. The state can be improved upon if we just do these things this way. They just saw the world our way. Alabama wouldn't be this backwards hick place that I think a lot of these reporters that come in to Alabama, work a few years, they kind of view the world that way. But I think what's important is these newspaper endorsements kind of verify that. These newspaper endorsements, they don't mean much politically. Maybe you fundraise off of them, or, hey, I'm the candidate that the Huntsville Times endorsed. Vote for me. No one's doing that, right? So I would say this, though. I think that's something that they're more writing for each other, that the newspaper endorsements are done to show, hey, look at us, New York Times, Washington Post, or whatever major media market. We're just like you, and we have people just like you, so give us a high five or whatever.
Except maybe fighting more of a fight in the other battleground. Maybe that's how some journalists feel. But I was going to ask, do you think that because the main reason, I mean, of course, you want a free press in America, but it's still a business model, and you got to sell the papers. You got to get people to click on your stories online. So did they run numbers, and some of these extra left-leaning publications in Alabama, did they run the numbers and decide that being in opposition to most of their readers gave them better numbers? Maybe the people didn't appreciate what they were reading, but they were tuning in anyway, or is it more of the state of journalism today?
Here's a dirty little secret about Alabama.
Okay.
And newspapers. They are sort of subsidized by what they call legal advertising. So the state of Alabama, by statutes, is you have to advertise your legal notices in XYZ places, and I think the courthouse is one. but the local newspaper is one as well. So while these newspapers exist, that people don't really get their news from, they're getting them from online sources or whatever, they still check a box for legal advertising. So people are required to post these ads in these newspapers for legal advertising. That keeps a lot of these really small newspapers afloat, and they're able to kind of have a differing view. They don't have to adjust with the market to exist. Now, some of the bigger papers, obviously, they don't. That's not necessarily true. I think like the Montgomery Advertiser is part of USA Today Network, and obviously the AL.com thing, it's more of a website company these days than it is a newspaper company. But some of these other newspapers exist for the sole reason that they get the legal ads, and that just kind of pays the bills, keeps the lights on, and keeps them churning out a product. Now, I don't think you're going to pick up the Monroe Journal or whatever and be like, oh my God, look at this liberal bias. But it does kind of take the marketplace and the sentiment of the average reader out of the equation when you don't have to worry about what they think, because you're going to get this advertising, just guaranteed advertising by statute in this newspaper, and they're going to make some revenue off of that. It's going to keep things afloat. You don't have to adjust with the times.
Yeah, and you could probably tell, because some of those newspapers, you go online and they don't have any presence. They might be in some mailboxes every week, but I can think of a couple off the top of my head where you try to find a story or go to their website and you can't even look at an article from that week.
Right, and they'll post the PDF of the paper online, but you got it's behind a paywall, and who's going to pay $50 a year for the Sumter Journal or whatever? Mm-hmm. You know, like that makes it really difficult, but. You know, the whole thing with that is it's the legal advertising. Now, if this ever changes, if the legislature ever says, hey, Alabama Press Association, we're going to take this away from you, we think people have access to internet. Now, generally, that's true. Most of the state, I think there's two or three places in the state of Alabama where you can't get a good quality, high-speed internet, some places in the Black Belt. And, and they're working on that. Now, I think once we get to that point where you have this sort of universal broadband or people can at least buy the internet, then you're going to have this situation where these newspapers are kept afloat through these legal advertising, you know, all the revenue they get from that. And but I think that the consequence of that is it allows newspapers to be more left of center in Alabama, which is a right-leaning state. My question is, when you think of, you know, right-leaning news outlets in Alabama, what are they? They're not it's talk radio, it's online, but there's not a newspaper like a Washington Times or a you know, whatever, the Washington Examiner that leans right, or a Wall Street Journal even, that you could get a conservative perspective. It is from top to bottom. The big papers in this state are left-leaning, and I don't think that really gives – I don't think it serves the public as well as it could. I think voters vote generally in Republican primaries. Meanwhile, the Democrats are really interested in what's going on in the Democratic primary. So you have a Brian Lyman who covers politics for the Montgomery Advertiser. He will give you the blow-by-blow of Democrat inside baseball from Nancy Worley, Joe Reed, and all the candidates they're fielding and how great it is. On the other side, like Republican, where things are really decided on the Republican side of the equation, you don't get as good coverage because I don't know. It just doesn't seem to be as interested in it. But you're in a state where Republicans, I think, outnumber Democrats at least 2-1, maybe 3-1 in some instances. And that's kind of where we are with journalism. And I think that's what's instructive. That's what you can learn from these endorsements, is that you get to see this really – you may – kind of sense the bias when you read a straight news story, but when you see their editorial board endorsing nothing but Democrat candidates, that kind of tells you where the state of journalism is, the legacy print media is in the state of Alabama.
Well, I think, and I know a lot of people would disagree with me, but I think it is important to have views on subjects from all different sides. So I think it is important to have Democrat voices, you know, voicing from their point of view. But when I get newsletters with the stories of the day, a lot of the emails that I get, I'm seeing the left-leaning op-eds, but I'm not seeing the right-leaning op-eds, which is just crazy in Alabama.
Yeah, we get Kyle Whitmire, John Archibald, the usual suspects, you know, another J.D. Crow cartoon making fun of Trump. Does America really need that right now? That's what just bludgeoned with that. And I don't think you get you don't have that conservative voice. They have like a Cameron Smith, who's an okay guy, but he's kind of a milquetoast conservative. He's your textbook conservative that you read about in college. He's not the guy that's going to make the case for the Trump policy, for, you know, for tariffs or whatever immigration policy. He's going to kind of go along the lines of traditional Republican country clubism and all these things. And that's not to knock my friend Cameron Smith, but I don't think you get kind of where the general, where the goalposts are for Republican politics in the state of Alabama. It tends to be really diehard Donald Trump, probably more diehard Donald Trump than anywhere in the country. You don't get that from the media here. You just, they pretend it doesn't exist as a position, and that's to their detriment, I think.
Well, we've had one debate on this week. I think it's time for that Jeff Poor Cameron Smith debate.
Again, we've done right it before. Time,
second so. Time here, but that's in the latest Lanyap issue, your article.
Yeah, and that's in the latest Lanyap on newsstands now. This is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5. Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan today, 251-343-0106. We got Donald Trump in Missouri. Columbia, Missouri tonight. I think he's stumping for Josh Hawley, who's running against incumbent Claire McCaskill. That race is a dead heat, I think. Really, here's what you need to know. Watch where Donald Trump goes, and that'll probably tell you what races are the ones you need to keep an eye on. You know, it might be a House district. It might be a gubernatorial race. In this case, tonight, it's going to be a Senate race. I think those are their pollsters are telling them, here's where you need to go. And there is a school of thought in Republican politics right now that if we look at 2016 and just how Donald Trump was running around the country and doing these rallies right at the waning days of the campaign, that's what pushed him over the top to beat Hillary Clinton. That's how he won Michigan and Pennsylvania and probably Wisconsin. He was on the ground. She wasn't. They think they can replicate that to some degree in some of these swing districts and some of these races that are very pivotal to keep for Republicans to keep control of the House. The polling didn't get that. And keep in mind, polling's always a lagging indicator. You don't really get a sense of where the race is by the polling you're looking at now, because it's a poll that was taken maybe a week ago. Things change, and everything is kind of, you know, everything's on the margins. There's people like me that obviously I'm not going to go Democrat. It's just a matter of getting like your Republican out the vote or your Democrat out the vote. But there are people that'll be like, oh, the President of the United States is down. Why is he in town? Oh, it's time to vote. Because midterm elections, you know, in this bubble, we think it's everything. But I think to a lot of people out there, it's just not really on the radar. But when Trump comes to your media market, when the President of the United States comes to your media market, traffic's tied up, or you get to see Air Force One flying over you, it does, oh, yeah, there's an election. I need to go pull the chain for somebody, and that might be the Republican. Now, maybe it has a negative effect, but I think the idea is, you know, really watch where he's going. You'll see kind of where the fight's going to be. Florida, obviously Pensacola, and Pensacola is Republican. Escambia County, that's Matt Gaetz territory over there. That's a Republican district, but this is just a get-out-the-vote play. It gets people engaged, and it gets people fired up, and maybe it gets them to tell their friends to go vote or whatever it may be. That's why you see what Trump's doing, and that's the kind of the tell where we are going into these midterms on Tuesday.
We've talked about it some already this show, but usually midterms, bad for the class, bad for for Republicans, or whoever's holding office. This would normally be really bad for Republicans going into midterms, just like when Barack Obama was president, not so good for the Democrats going into the midterms. But with President Trump, he still seems to be the number one needle mover, and he's making this 8-state trip that he's doing going into the midterms. I'm interested because, you know, everyone always says that he doesn't take direction from his staff, but somebody there has to be saying, listen, these are the states you need to hit, and Trump, he has to be listening, or is he looking at the map himself, looking at how the politics are lining up and going, you know, I need to go down to Florida and I need to go to Missouri. I doubt he's setting this up himself.
I think Mitch McConnell, leader of the Senate, Republican leader of the Senate, is in his ear a little bit. I've always thought that relationship is probably a little bit stronger than it seems. We know this because Donald Trump came to Alabama and campaigned for Luther Strange, who was Mitch McConnell's guy. Trump may tweet something about Mitch McConnell and not getting, you know, the past the filibuster rule or all the stuff he wanted to do with Obamacare. But I think that Trump and McConnell are probably a little bit closer than you think. We know that Trump and Lindsey Graham are close. We know this from Woodward's book. We know this from the Wolf book. We know that kind of after the campaign, they had an ugly campaign. Remember, Donald Trump gave out Lindsey Graham's phone number.
Oh, man. I forgot about that.
Cell phone number. Yeah. Well, they made amends, and you learned it. Like, Lindsey Graham will take Donald Trump's phone call at all hours of the day and night, which is something Donald Trump, I think, values. So he could go do a big event with the Chinese, the president of China or whatever, and it could go to the late hours, and then he could go call Lindsey Graham at 1 a.m., and Graham will take his phone call and kind of advise him. I think he's got some of these people in his ears that are telling him, look, you need to go here, 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 and here. And I think a lot of it that's why it's kind of very U.S. Senate-centric, you know. So, like, Dean Heller in Nevada, Sinema in the Mosali race in Arizona, these are Senate races. They're not necessarily House races or gubernatorial elections. But that's what you want to watch, I think. But here's one thing I'll say about the party in power kind of conventional wisdom, that this is supposed to be a bad year for Republicans. Pollsters don't have a good model of what it's like for the Democrats to be out of power and be in a midterm situation. Now, what we've learned from these last few elections, Democrats don't show up like Republicans do for midterms. Now, is that just a product of who's in the White House and what's going on there? I don't know. But I tend to think their modeling may be a little off, because they're trying to look at this from the perspective that, hey, we got a Republican in office. You know, it'll be just like when a Democrat's in office. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's necessarily true. They don't have a really good model. The last time we were in this situation was 2002. 9/11 had happened. Republicans gained seats. So you don't really have that as a model. You had the six-year itch election in 2006, but this is different. This is only 2 years out of a presidential election. And then I think you had to go all the way back to 1990. That was the last time you had a new Republican president and a Congress. And even then, the Democrats didn't pick up as much ground as they thought they could or they should have. So I think that's instructive. And I think, you know, when you look at all the polling and all the prognostications, what's it based on? How are they modeling their polls? How are these models set up? Is it in a way that they think they're going to get a turnout from Democrats that may not be there? And we had this sort of situation with Hillary. They thought that they were going to turn out the vote in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. They didn't. Donald Trump won Pennsylvania. They thought they were going to turn out the vote in Detroit. They didn't. Donald Trump won Michigan. And they thought they were going to turn out the vote in Milwaukee. They didn't. The votes just were, the Democrat precincts wasn't there, and it allowed for Trump to have a win that won him the presidency.
Well, immigration and birthright citizenship have become huge issues. I mean, you can't turn on the TV without seeing about that. And you got a guest coming up next to discuss the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, Joe Pollack of Breitbart News is coming up next on FM Talk 106.5. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And this is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan today on FM Talk 106.5. Joining us on the line now is my colleague at Breitbart News, Joe Pollack, who's actually at the border right now and is, I think, working on some stories down there kind of about this incoming caravan situation. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good to be with you here. I'm actually looking into Mexico. We're on a little rise here, a hilltop overlooking the border fence, which is not much because we don't have the wall yet, but looking into Tijuana, basically, and it's quite an attractive neighborhood we're looking at, and you can see the border fence going all the way west of here across another hilltop and then down to the sea, and it winds east up into the mountains. But we've got Congressman Duncan Hunter here today. He's going to be making his case for building the wall and stopping the caravan. He's in a tough re-election race against a Democratic challenger, Amar Campanajar, who was considered a long shot and has some interesting things in his family background. He's the grandson of a very important Palestinian terrorist, which is not usually the kind of pedigree you want to advertise, but he's got a chance because Hunter and his wife were indicted on charges of misusing campaign funds.
Right.
Back in August. So it's a high political drama here at the border in San Diego.
That's generally one of the more secure parts of the border, I think, just because of the population centers that are adjacent to it.
Yeah, this is a solid Republican district, the 50th District of California. But again, competitive this year. When candidates get themselves into trouble, when incumbents get themselves into trouble with the law, that's usually a bad thing. Although in two races where Republicans are having that trouble, one here and one in New York. Both Republicans are leading in the polls, narrowly, but leading. And that's partly because voters don't want Nancy Pelosi, at least Republican voters, don't want Nancy Pelosi as Speaker. And they know that that's what's at stake. So they're willing to figure itself out. If the incumbent goes down, then they'll wait for the special election. But they just don't want to be represented by a Democrat.
Joe, the reason I ask you on, I kind of saw one of your tweets talking about the 14th Amendment and your interpretation and sort of the birthright citizenship question that Donald Trump's really pushed out there and I think made a campaign issue by virtue of putting out there this Axios HBO interview. Now, it's not, you know, the way we're told is that the 14th Amendment says what it says, that birthright citizenship is part of the Constitution, but that may not necessarily be the case. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Right. Well, birthright citizenship is currently the law of the land. If you're born in America, you have a claim to citizenship. That's based on the 14th Amendment, but the conservative originalists come down on different sides of this question. Many, like myself, say, yeah, the 14th Amendment guarantees birthright citizenship, but there is a school, also conservative originalists, who look at the text and say, wait a minute, there's a little clause in that 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And if you interpret that the way the senator who led the drive to pass the 14th Amendment interpreted it, then you've got to recognize that it wasn't intended to apply to people who were citizens of another country. So that would seem to undo the idea that you can come here illegally and have a child, and that child will be a U.S. citizen. There's a little debate about it, but as Mark Levin has pointed out, we didn't really grant birthright citizenship to a lot of people until the last 50 years or so. So there's all kinds of questions. Our colleague at Breitbart, Ken Kukowski, has written about how Congress is allowed to end birthright citizenship. He's made a constitutional case for that. Trump has taken it a step further by saying he might issue an executive order. No one's clear what would be in that executive order. It might just be a direction to federal agencies not to do some of the things they were doing to facilitate birthright citizenship. Maybe it doesn't cancel birthright citizenship, but just cancel some sort of executive action about it. Nobody really knows. But what was interesting was that Lindsey Graham, who's often a critic of the president, came out right away and endorsed the president's idea and said he wants to do it legislatively, which is the way Ken Kukowski said would be best. And it looks like Republicans might do it. It sparked an interesting debate. The majority of Americans actually oppose birthright citizenship, including liberals. My favorite recent example was Paris Hilton, you know, the celebrity who said that she doesn't like Trump, but she agrees that birthright citizenship is bad. The idea that you could just come here, have a child, and the child will be a citizen. It does incentivize lawbreaking and illegal immigration. So really just an interesting debate that he has sparked, and it's probably helped him refocus the campaign on the border issues, on the immigration issues, which is where he was strongest.
Well, let's play a hypothetical here. Let's say he issues this executive order and he goes through the court system. Do we finally get an answer to this question about the 14th Amendment? Does this lend itself to the Supreme Court saying definitively, this is the law of the land? And just given the makeup of the court now, what could you see happening if that were the situation?
It's very hard to tell because we've got a conservative majority on the court. But again, conservatives disagree over this. And I don't know enough about the individual decisions of the individual justices, nor I suspect as anybody, because this issue hasn't really come up very often. So I think that it could be an interesting case where you could see originalist conservatives on different sides of the issue. It probably depends on the particulars of what they put in that executive order. We're going to keep in mind, of course, that the lawyers who are advising the president will also be constitutional originalist conservatives. So it's going to be a debate among people who generally agree about how the Constitution should be interpreted, and so it's going to be interesting for that reason.
Does it matter if it's by executive order or by statute, do you think, with the court order rule?
It might. I mean, I think it's a much stronger case if you get rid of birthright citizenship by statute. Everybody agrees you could get rid of it by constitutional amendment. That's harder to do. But you could get rid of it by statute, probably. That's the case made by Ken Kukowski. And executive order might be a bit more difficult, certainly harder to pass muster at the Supreme Court level. But again, it depends what that executive order does. If it just directs agencies to do something that they're constitutionally and lawfully empowered to do, like, for example, refrain from facilitating the process for people. You know, maybe they have to go to court to get their birthright citizenship, not just automatically provided some kind of government documentation or something like that. I don't know the particulars, but it could just be a direction to federal agencies. That's probably within the president's power anyway. So it depends what's in that executive order. President Trump said yesterday he expects it to be decided by the Supreme Court one day, one way or another. So I think that's where we're headed with this.
Yeah, we'll wrap it.
I think the congressman's coming down here, so I'm going to have to march over there and make sure I talk to him. He has not done very many interviews this campaign, so we're going to see what we can get him on record as saying, and you'll see it covered on Breitbart.com later.
All right, Joel. Well, I appreciate your time, and make sure you get that interview. We don't want to hold you up, but that's Joel. All right, man. Thanks for coming on. That's Joel Pollack with Breitbart, my colleague at Breitbart, a editor at large.
Yeah, and down there working on an important story, especially for him, but for the nation, working on that story down there on the border with that caravan heading north and birthright citizenship becoming such a huge topic over the last couple of days. And before we wrap up the show real quick, I do want to remind everyone, it is holiday season, and with holiday season comes parties, of course, whether it's work parties or family parties. And the best place to go ahead and pick up some gear, pick up some stuff to take to those parties would be Cottage Hill Package Store, one of my favorite places ever to just... period. That's it. I love Cottage Hill Package Store, and they have you covered. They have craft beer, wine, spirits, and cigars. I mean, a massive humidor at Cottage Hill Package Store. And don't forget, Havana Rays Lounge just opened up there on Airport in Midtown. Havana Rays Lounge, they have the cigar lounge out back. They have a bar inside, and you can go ahead and actually reserve a space there at Havana Rays for a holiday party if you're trying to find a place to take your work crew, your employees, or colleagues. Havana Rays Lounge is a great place to do that. And Cottage Hill Package Store, if you want to buy some great beer, craft beers, wine, liquor, cigars, they have you covered there. That's kind of one of my tricks, is if I'm going to a friend's, if my friend has a birthday or if we've got a gift-giving scenario coming up, I get them a bottle of bourbon or a bottle of scotch, and if they end up not being a bourbon or scotch drinker, then that becomes your present. They just re-gift it to you right there. So Cottage Hill Package Store, check them out on Cottage Hill and Hillcrest, and Havana Rays Cigar Shop and Lounge on Airport in Midtown, and also online, cottagehillpackagestore.com. 5 minutes here till the end of the hour, and we've been talking about the midterms quite a bit over the last couple of hours here, Jeff, and as far as Alabama goes, statewide, no really, really close races. When you think of the big races, governor, lieutenant governor, right, those have kind of distanced themselves. The Republicans have distanced themselves from the Democrats there.
So the two people we're talking about that are not going to be as big as the governor's race and the, obviously, lieutenant governor's race, I think Ainsworth and Ivey are pretty safe bets. The ones that might be closer are the Chief Justice race between Tom Parker and Bob Vance. And the Attorney General's race all of a sudden is mildly interesting, just because you have Joe Singelman, who has name ID, and you have Steve Marshall, who the Singelman camp is claiming that they violated Alabama's pack-to-pack transfer laws, and by taking money from the Republican Attorney General's Association, putting it into in his campaign coffers, and this is what he used to run against in the primary against Troy King, against Chess Bedsole, and against Alice Martin, and that, you know, that gave him an advantage that he shouldn't have had. So you have this pack-to-pack transfer question that might be clouding the candidacy, Steve Marshall. But I, you know what, I think instead of winning by 20 points, he wins by 15 points, maybe. the one thing that I would say about that race is there may be a number of people out there that look at this and say, oh, Singelman, I know that name from Don Singelman. Now, that carries some baggage, but maybe they see it and they say, oh, I don't really remember much about him, but I know the name. I'll check this box, and that's what happens. I could see that being maybe worth a point or two, a few thousand votes or whatever. Throw that out there. The Chief Justice race, mm-hmm. That's the more interesting one. When we talk about the Chief Justice race and you talk about Bob Vance, he has kind of the trial lawyer's support. When you drive around some of these neighborhoods that are Republican voting, you'll see a lot of Bob Vance signs in their yards. That's Spring Hill. That's Mountain Brook in Birmingham. That's Cloverdale and Montgomery. You see Bob Vance. He's got a lot of money backing him. He's running against Tom Parker, who doesn't have as much money backing him and is unable to do the things that the Vance is doing. But I think at the end of the day, when you look at that ballot, if you make it, if the people make it past the vote straight Republican part, they're going to still see that R next to that name, and I think it's still a race for Parker to win over Vance.
Well, that about wraps it up for today's Midday Mobile, but you'll be back in the seat tomorrow filling in for Sean Sullivan. If you can let me in, what do we have planned for tomorrow? Anything, what you want to talk about?
So we got one confirmed guest for tomorrow. We have Mac McCutcheon's counterpart in the state Senate. We have Del Marsh, who's the president of the Senate. We're going to roughly talk about some of the same things coming up, and he's got his own election bid next week, so we're going to talk a little bit about that, but that's on the plate for tomorrow.
All right, that does it. This is Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. That's Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan. I'm Dalton Orwig, and I'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning with Kelly Finley on Mobile Mornings. We get it started at 6. Now on the way next, Paul Feinbaum. I'm sure he'll talk about that big Alabama-LSU matchup coming up on Saturday. Have a great one, everyone.